TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Bill McKibben on Deep Economy. A talk and conversation with Michael Pollan. Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, is regarded as the first book for a general audience about climate change. Published in 1989, it has been printed in more than 20 languages. He has since written on localization, alternative energy, and the risks associated with genetic engineering. In his most recent book, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, he envisions a transition to local-scale enterprise. McKibben and his family live in Vermont. He's a scholar in residence at Middlebury College, where he launched the campaign Step It Up 2007, demanding that global warming pollution be cut 80% by 2050. McKibben spoke in Berkeley in March 2007. The church was filled to capacity with an animated crowd. He was joined on stage by a colleague and fellow author, Michael Pollan. Here is Bill McKibben.
Deep Economy is an attempt to provide a pretty radical challenge to the most basic notion of our lives on this planet at the moment. And that most basic notion is that more is better, and that economic expansion and economic growth are the reasons that we're here and the reasons that we have government and the obvious point of most human endeavor. There's two problems with that notion, I think. One of them is the obvious one, that it's driving us over an ecological cliff. And if you doubt that even for a minute, just try to do the math about what would happen if the rest of the world tried to live as they are now trying to live, the way that middle-class Americans do. The Chinese, with their economy growing 10% a year, will be about as rich as we are if that continues by the middle of this century. If the Chinese, and the Chinese alone, owned automobiles in the same profusion that we did, the current number of 800 million automobiles on the planet would be joined by 1.1 billion in China alone. If the Chinese eight-hour diet, okay, with its heavy use of corn-fed meat and things, the Chinese alone would soak up about two-thirds of the world's grain harvest, a grain harvest that isn't getting any bigger. It's not physically possible to continue this model very much further into the future. But it also turns out, and this was the part that in a way was most interesting for me, it's not even, I think, a very good idea for the most kind of basic reason that it's no longer making us any happier. It's no longer producing that thing that it's supposed to be producing, some kind of human satisfaction. Now, this is a new notion, and it's only in the last 10 years or so that the economists and other academics have really begun to look at this. Before that, it seemed happiness, satisfaction seemed too soft a notion, and the kind of standard economic answer was that the concept of utility was sufficient, that we knew what made people happy by what they bought, okay? That sufficed. But when people began looking more deeply and trying to figure out what was really going on, the results were pretty amazing. Every year since the end of World War II, a polling firm has asked Americans, "Are you happy with your lives?" Which must be actually a kind of disconcerting phone call to get before dinner. But the number of people who answer, "I'm very happy with my life," peaks in 1956 and goes slowly but steadily downhill. About a quarter of Americans will now admit to being very happy. That's extremely strange, because that downward curve coexists with a trebling of our prosperity in that same period, our standard of living. The things that we tell ourselves about our economy and our economic life indicate that those two curves should move at least somewhat in the same direction. That they don't is pretty alarming. It's pretty alarming because in that 50-year period, we've done unbelievable damage to the world around us in the pursuit of that more, and it doesn't seem to have amounted to very much. It doesn't seem to have made us any happier. And the question quickly becomes, what's the reason for this? Why? What explains that downward curve? And there are a lot of different candidates for sort of possible answers, but the research seems to be centering pretty conclusively on the idea that what's going on is a tremendous loss of social connection, a tremendous loss of a sense of community among Americans. If you think about the dates almost, it makes sense. I mean, what started happening in the 1950s? As we got richer, we built larger houses further out in the suburbs. Almost mathematically, the chances of sort of connection between people were reduced. And indeed, that's precisely what happened. The average number of close friends that an American has dropped by about half in that 50-year period. That's a pretty big change. It's been similar huge reductions in the number of times and amount of time that people spend, say, eating meals with friends, family, relatives. Something that we should talk about, Michael should talk about when we talk about food, because, of course, what we eat is only half of dinner. The other half is sort of who we eat it with and under what circumstances. That loss of social connection is so deep that it's apparently undermined whatever gains would have come from this new prosperity. And in fact, it's so deep and basic that we can measure it in the most dramatic terms. If you can find an American, and there are tens of millions of them, who don't belong to something, who aren't part of some organization or another, and you can convince them to join a church choir, a softball league, you know, whatever it is, their mortality, the chance that they will die, drops in the next year by half. Okay? It's not a kind of subtle effect that you have to work hard to tease out of the data. It's an incredibly powerful reminder of who we are, you know, a social animal, now living in a kind of condition that doesn't really take that into account. And so much of the book, most of the book, is devoted to sort of exploring the question of whether there might be something we could figure out to do that would try to address both these sets of issues, the ecological and the social trouble that we find ourselves in. And the good news, I think, is that there very much is, that the logical solution to both of them lies pretty much down the same path, which will make that path somewhat easier to take. And that is moving gradually but decisively in the direction of smaller, more local economies that emphasize much more relation and much less stuff, that emphasize belonging, not belongings. We can begin to see these forming in things like local farmers markets, which are now the fastest growing part of our food economy. Thank heaven. And they're growing fast for all the kind of obvious reasons that come up, and all the subtle reasons that Michael's explored so well in his work, having to do with food and all of that. But they're also expanding because they're very different experience. If you eat out of a farmer's market, generally, you use something between 5 and 15 times less energy to feed yourself. So let's say an order of magnitude. But you also, according to a study by a pair of sociologists who followed people first around supermarkets and then around farmers markets. I mean, you've all been to the supermarket thing, so you know the routine. You walk in, you sort of fall into a light trance. You visit the stations of the cross around the perimeter of the supermarket. You somehow emerge with exactly the same set of things that you did the week before, and perhaps you have the kind of interesting conversation about paper or plastic on the way out the door. When they followed people around the farmer's market, they had 10 times as many conversations in the course of the visit. 10 times. I mean, sociologists are used to measuring 0.18, you know, percent, whatever. 10, they had an order of magnitude more community and an order of magnitude less energy And you begin to sense the kind of possibility for leverage on a scale large enough to alter a little bit the situation we find ourselves in. The book tries to take this analysis beyond food, where it's been, where we've done the most work, into whole other sets of commodities and ideas, into energy, into even into sort of ephemeral commodities like art and communication, you know, because the same forces that make Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland the centralized headquarters of calories in America, and that make ExxonMobil and a few huge utilities the centralized headquarters of electrons and power in America, make, you know, Clear Channel and Infinity the centralized headquarters of radio signals in America. I mean, the same analysis works all the way through. If we can figure out how to break down some of those huge monoliths and replace them with human scale economies that once again throw us into some kind of dependence, into some kind of real interchange with our neighbors, then the possibilities, not for preventing global warming, but for keeping it from getting worse than it has to be, and for dealing with the effects of what is coming, no matter what we do, are greatly enhanced. And so are the possibility of not having our children see their lives grow ever less satisfied and ever less happy as well. I think it's an interesting moment. Clearly, we're beginning to sense that we've taken our approach to the world about as far as it can go, and it's no longer yielding fruit for us. We're going to be doing something different. It's a great moment to try to figure out what that might be. And Michael, if you'll come up, we can talk a little bit about what that might be. Thank you.
Thank you. That was great. One of the things that most impressed me when I read this book, which I think I read, I guess, last winter, was for a book about limits, for a book about a world in which there is kind of a sword of Damocles over our heads, it's a remarkably, almost bracingly cheerful book. There is just so much positive energy and sense of hope, but not forced at all. And I think a lot of it comes from you work very successfully to kind of de-link prosperity and happiness for us. But at the risk of spoiling the mutual admiration, one of the questions that it raises is, although the evidence is there that at least for our society, prosperity is not buying us happiness, there are literally billions of people all over the world who feel that if they could get that car, get that house, get that TV, that they will be more happy. And up to a certain point, that might be true. And who are we to say, you really shouldn't go down that path, it wasn't that satisfying?
We have not only no right, but no ability to say that. That's one of the questions that kind of haunts the book. I've spent a lot of time in China, particularly all over the developing world, but in China in the last few years, trying to kind of puzzle out that question. Because it's completely true that if you're living in rural China, you know, 8 to a room in a hovel, which is how people are living in rural China right now, trying to survive on half an acre of marginal land because there's so little land left, and, you know, your water is disappearing. I mean, it is absolutely true that in that circumstance, more still is linked to better. You have community to spare. There are, you know, 4 people in your bed at night, okay? So there's no lack of community, and a little more money gets you enough food, and it gets you... In fact, I was thinking of that. Did anybody else read the story in the Times, New York Times last week, about how the new trend in American houses and things is to have dual master bedrooms because husbands and wives can no longer be bothered sleeping in the same bed because one likes it warmer than the other or something. You know, we're our culture's on the edge of turning into farce, you know. The bad news is they can't follow our example because we've spoiled it for them. There's not enough atmosphere left to accommodate everyone trying to do this. The good news is that there is a kind of emerging set of ideas and appropriate technologies that allow people to live much better lives without following that particular path. And some of the ones I talk about in there, as you know, have to do with kind of innovative agriculture that's causing us to understand that, in fact, the most productive farms in this world are small farms, 6 and 8 and 10 acre farms that manage to do an awful lot of, you know, integrated systems that produce a lot of food and a lot of calories and enough surplus to allow farmers to have some margin in their lives, on and on and on like that. But if we continue blithely to pursue precisely the way of life that we're pursuing, it's extremely hard for those things to gain the momentum that they need to gain. Our biggest export in this country is motion pictures and television shows, i.e. our idea of the good life. All I know is that we need to take strong steps here, and if we do, there's some chance that we'll both open up enough margin for the rest of the world and point in a slightly different direction for the rest of the world, too.
I want to go back to a point you made that just kind of slipped by, which is you were saying small farms are more productive than large farms. Now, the general sense is that industrial agriculture has been an enormously productive and efficient invention, and that I think the numbers are like 100 years ago, the average farmer grew enough food for 13 other people besides their family, and now a corn farmer in Iowa can grow enough food for 129 people. So how do those two ideas square?
I mean, agriculture is more productive now because we learned how to use oil in vast quantities to make it more productive, obviously, as you've described in great length. And B, because we got rid of, I mean, the ratio changed because we got rid of most of the farmers. I mean, there are now way more prisoners in America than there are farmers. That's a sort of discouraging statistic. But we've confused two kinds of productivity. If you want the most yield of food per dollar invested, then a huge, you know, sprawling agribusiness farm is the way to go, because you can reduce your labor costs almost to nothing and have one guy patrolling, you know, tens of thousands of acres in some cases. If you want the most yield per acre, it turns out, according to the USDA, that those 10 and 12 acre farms produce the most food per acre, and the reason is obvious. You know your farm. You know what to grow, what grows well where, and how to grow it. We're obviously not going to go back to 50% of Americans farming, but it's incredibly encouraging, I think, around the country to see new farming really beginning to take off in all kinds of places, to see states where the number of farms has finally begun to go up again instead of down, and almost always because it's surrounding a metropolitan area that started taking local food seriously.
Yeah, it is the first time, I think, in American history where the number of farmers is not declining at the moment. The farms coming in now do tend to be very small, and they're serving local markets, but it does suggest some new people maybe getting into farming. What about, though, elsewhere in the world? There is now talk about a second green revolution with some kind of modified understanding that there was something less than great about the first one, but basically sharing the assumption that the answer in terms of global poverty is to raise agricultural yields now through genetically modified crops as much as chemicals, and that because the goal is to get people out of subsistence, off the farm, but out of subsistence so they'll have enough to enter the world trade system and that they'll have a surplus that they can sell. And I'm kind of struck given what, I mean, I think you're absolutely right what you say about the Green Revolution and what we learned and that the gains were very temporary, that we seem to be about to go down that same path again. Why do you think that is?
I think because a sort of a poverty of imagination that doesn't allow us to consider any model other than our own as a kind of possibility for what we might do. We're so convinced that the world that we've built here is the only possible endpoint for a good society. And, I mean, this is the good explanation. The ulterior one is that, you know, in order to support our particular society, it helps us to get a lot of other people enmeshed in particular sort of things, but to give it the best possible spin. That's why it's so interesting to start looking at our society and ask how well it works and how well it works for us. It's not that, you know, it's not that anyone's going to give up the hope of a certain amount of modernity. The questions are more, have more to do with trajectory. I mean, at the moment, say, a really big question is, will the Chinese and the Indians take as their model the U.S. or Europe, Western Europe, as a kind of direction toward which to evolve? It would make a big difference, because in Western Europe, because people have a stronger sense of community and are willing to pay the taxes to support it, you know, they've done things like build public transportation, build good cities that draw people in. They use half as much energy per capita as the average American. Half is a big number. I mean, it's a way bigger number than we're going to get from talking about hydrogen and, you know, all the other sort of miracle technologies that theoretically are going to help us. I mean, half is a lot. And what's interesting about that half is, remember I described these sort of declining satisfaction scores among Americans? It hasn't happened in Europe. That same, the numbers are flat or rising. They've built a society that works somewhat better than ours works. We're going to be grasping for all kinds of solutions in the developed world and in the developing world for ways to get something that works, because plan A isn't possible. It just, there isn't enough stuff and enough atmosphere to make it happen. And if that's all we can think of, then we're just going to drive straight off the cliff.
What you're talking about, I think, when you talk about the decline of community as we've gotten more affluent, you're talking about sort of Daniel Bell's idea, right? The cultural contradictions of capitalism and the way that capitalism seems to erode the sort of social basis on which it first was able to thrive. Why do you think that hasn't been so much the case in Europe?
They locate themselves differently along the spectrum of community to sort of hyper-individualism. My guess is it has something to do with the after-effects of World War. They've been more singed by the reality of what happens when community breaks down and things get completely out of control. You know, the experiment that we're running in this country is so profound. I did this book years ago, this odd book, called The Age of Missing Information, which was this like experiment where I found the largest cable TV system in the world, which at the time had 100 channels in Fairfax, Virginia. I taped everything that came across them for one day. So I had 2,400 hours of TV. I took it back with me to the woods where I lived. I went to Sears and bought a recliner. And and I settled in and I spent a year watching television. That was my job. And there were, you know, the book's filled with a lot of sort of insights about things. But the basic message that flows out of that cable all the time and out of every part of our consumer society is you're the most important thing on earth. You know, you're the center of the universe. Everything should flow around you. We've so internalized that now that we call it human nature in our society. And if anyone proposes anything that seems, you know, vaguely idealistic or earnest or someone say, that goes against human nature. Clearly, that's a part of our nature, but for most of human history, people figure, you know, had in most places still, people had some other set of things that helped them identify who they were. You know, they were their community, their tribe, their relationship with the natural world, with the divine, something that allowed them not to be at the center of everything. And that turns out to be a kind of, I think, a sort of more satisfying place for us to be. And it's definitely an ecologically sounder one. I mean, you know, the idea that we're the center of everything is echoed at the moment by, you know, by the kind of complete policy failure over global warming in Washington. It's so impossible for these guys to grapple with the fact that we're going to have to change that they engage in sort of ludicrous junk science and denial of reality. And I think it's because at some level, the economy has become more real to people than the real world has. I mean, think of the words we use about the economy is ailing, you know. It's had a setback, you know. Oh, it's in recovery, you know, on and on and on. I mean, we're so tender toward it. But the real world is just like, you know, well, what the hell, just trash this. There are plenty of people in Washington, I think, who think that the sort of laws of physics and chemistry sort of operate the way the tax code does, that you just change them and ignore them or something, and something happens. And it's,
or if people are feeling optimistic, good things.
Right, well, right? It's right. It's a, you know, it's a happy smile, clap hard enough, and, you know, right, everything will be okay. We're in for a kind of rude shock about all that, and we're beginning to get it. And, you know, I mean, the event that sort of, I think 100 years from now, the event we'll look back on more than September 11th even was Hurricane Katrina. Mm. And for what it began to reveal about all kinds of things, you know, class and race and the real position of human beings in relation to the size of the natural world.
You heard the first part of a conversation between Bill McKibben and Michael Pollan. McKibben had come to Berkeley to talk about his most recent book, Deep Economy. McKibben was joined by Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. Pollan is professor of journalism at UC Berkeley. The event was hosted by Global Exchange. Come back for part two when TUC Radio returns. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.